Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Jonathan Cohn, representing the United States of America. Your Honors, this FOIA case concerns a unique set of records that exists only because of the special statutory relationship that the White House and the Vice President have with the Secret Service, and consistent with their mutual pre-existing understanding with the service, the White House and OVP unambiguously asserted exclusive control over these records, in which the Secret Service has no ongoing interest, and which the Secret Service possesses temporarily only because of the unique protective statute, the only purpose of which was to protect the President and the Vice President and the White House and the VP's residence.
The assumption expressed in your statement as to the pre-existing understanding isn't what this case is about, whether there was such a pre-existing understanding.
That's one of the points that plaintiff makes, Your Honor. In our view is that there was a pre-existing understanding that dates back at least until 2001. But in any event, Your Honor, in 2006, May of 2006, a good 5 months before the FOIA request was made, the parties entered into, the parties being the White House and Secret Service, entered into an unambiguous, unequivocal memorandum of understanding which asserted conclusively that control over these records lies in the hands of the White House and not the Secret Service.
Does that apply to documents that were created before the 2006 memorandum?
It does, Your Honor.
Plaintiffs, I believe, are actually seeking documents that were created before that memorandum, right?
Indeed, Your Honor. And it does apply to those records for a few reasons. First, as the Supreme Court established in Tax Analysts, the relevant question is whether control was asserted before the FOIA request was made. Was the FOIA request made at a time during which there was control? And in this case, the MOU was signed in May of 2006, a good 5 months before the FOIA request. So control was already conclusively established as being in the hands of the White House and not the Secret Service. So under Tax Analysts and the subsequent cases, there was control lying in the hands of the White House and not the Secret Service. But it's important not to forget the uniqueness of these records in this case, Your Honor. These records are quintessentially related to White House activities. We're talking about records that
were the entire record? I understand your point about the information on the record which indicates who the person is visiting, particularly if it's the President or the Vice President. I understand that. But beyond that, what on those documents is so quintessentially presidential?
Your Honor, the information such as the name and the identifying information.
Why? That the name of the person visiting the White House?
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, that's a public building. I mean, you could stand out on 17th Street and keep track of who goes in and out, right?
Theoretically, one might try to do that. Of course, the Secret Service might have some qualms if someone was
positioned. They might have qualms, but they really couldn't stop you from doing it.
Right.
Whether they could or could not stop someone from standing outside the White House 24 hours a day with a camera taking pictures, even if there are other means.
I didn't say anything about a camera, by the way.
That was my embellishment to the hypothetical.
It does make it better from your perspective.
Except you're embellishing the case we have.
No, I mean, I guess my question is, wouldn't the government's interests here be completely satisfied if you could delete the information on the line that identifies who the person is meeting with?
No, Your Honor. The
Why
fact,
is that?
Well, for a couple reasons. One, the plaintiffs believe, and this might be correct, that they can determine who's asserting influence in the White House by determining the number of visits that someone makes to the White House, even if you don't know the identity of the recipient of the visit.
I thought the government's argument was that because of the requirement that the President and the Vice President have Secret Service protection, that the plaintiffs can obtain essentially the President's personal calendar, which would not otherwise be available, right?
That's
your argument.
That's one of the arguments. That's one of the concerns we have. But we do have a concern, Your Honor, with the mere fact that plaintiffs will be able to find out who is visiting the White House and how often, even if they don't know the recipient of the visitor. For instance, plaintiffs,
why is that what's the basis for protecting that information? I mean, suppose someone's regularly attending, going to the White House to meet with the chef.
Your Honor, well, first of all, I don't think there's any suggestion that the nine individuals in question in this case were meeting with the White House chef.
Well,
but
suppose they weren't meeting with the president or vice president. Suppose they were meeting with the White House social office.
Well, we don't know who they're visiting with, but surely one can glean some information from the sheer number of visits that an individual makes to the White House. Even if you don't know whether it's the president or the chief of staff or the White House counsel's office, plaintiffs, I'm sure, would agree that if Jerry Falwell made 20 visits or 100 visits to the White House, that would reveal some information, and that's one of the reasons, I bet, why they made this FOIA request, to find out how much influence an individual has, and the influence can be determined in part by the number of visits
but
the
why
person...
Why isn't that legitimate public information?
Well, Your Honor, Congress made a deliberate choice to exempt the president, the vice
but
president...
But not the Secret Service.
Correct, Your Honor, but the question is whether this court would allow plaintiffs to obtain indirectly that which they clearly cannot obtain directly from the White House. And for a few reasons, this court should say, no, that's not going to happen. One of those reasons is the memorandum of understanding in this case.
Suppose that memorandum of understanding had not come into existence at all. Now, we are dealing in part, in large part, with documents that were created before the memorandum of understanding. If it had not come into being at all, would you have a case?
Yes, Your Honor, and two things. First,
the handling of the documents before the creation of the memorandum of understanding was not uniform, was it? I mean, the emails were not, or the documents were not routinely placed into the White House database and taken away from the Secret Service.
Well, a couple of things about that, Your Honor. First of all, of course, we believe that the memorandum of understanding applies to all the records because the relevant...
Yes, I understand that, and you understand that I'm asking you to have...
Absolutely. Assuming...
So do that.
Yeah.
Don't mention memorandum of understanding.
I won't, Your Honor. I promise I'll not mention the memorandum. Even without the MO, if it never existed, these records are still not agency records for a few reasons. One is that there still was an understanding between the White House, OVP, and the Secret Service that these records were under the exclusive control under the White House and OVP. And that, in this context, in light of this unique...
Probably rephrasing my question, how are we to know that from the evidence absent the memorandum we're not talking about?
We have the declarations, Your Honor. And the declarations establish that... Well, let's start with the Waves, for example. The Waves records, starting in 2001, were being transferred periodically every 30 or 60 days to the White House. The Secret Service has no ongoing interest in these records warranting retention. And the only reason why they have these records at all, Your Honor, is that unique protective statute, the purpose of which was not to broaden disclosure requirements or intrude on the presidency, but simply to provide protection. And so the declarations established that, starting with the Waves, that there was an understanding predating the MOU, and pursuant to the understanding, the records were transferred to the White House every 30 or 60 days. And turning towards the VP residence, records, Your Honor, you see a similar pattern. The post-entry logs were being transferred periodically to OVP. The Secret Service was not keeping a copy because they had no ongoing interest warranting any retention. For the other records...
Now, at some point, this was stopped because the archivist stopped it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's very vague in the briefs as to how that came about. What authority did the archivist assert?
The archivist was concerned about potential infractions of either the Presidential Records Act or the Federal Records Act, and for that reason, the archivist wanted to make sure that we were properly considering these records, and communications resumed, and then in 2006, the issue was fully resolved, and it was determined that we were treating these records correctly as presidential
and
records.
And then you went back to the previous practice.
Well, we're still retaining, at this point, we're retaining these
because
records.
Because of the litigation.
Exactly.
Let me ask you a question. Judge Tatel focused on the Secret Service as the agency. I want to focus on something else, and that is the Executive Office of the President. As I understand your theory, following United We Stand, these records are requested by the White House, and therefore anything in the record that reflects the fact that the White House requested them is non-agency because the White House is non-agency. Is that about right?
That's part of it, correct, Your Honor.
All right. So, but the fact is that under FOIA, the Executive Office of the President is an agency, The part of the White House that isn't is the White House office, namely the president and close advisors, and I'll, for the purposes of this discussion, we'll give you the OVP as well. But it's clearly the case that there are parts of what we call the White House complex, particularly in the old executive office building, in the new executive office building, that our agent, that our agencies under FOIA. Is that right?
Yes, parts of EOP are FOIA entities. That's correct, Your Honor.
So if the request came from them, or the document or any part of the Secret Service's information came from the part of the White House that is an agency, you wouldn't have an argument under United We Stand, right?
Well, we still would have an argument,
How
Your Honor. A couple things. One, United We Stand did not say that you can assert control over records only if those records pertain to a non-FOIA entity. But let me just phrase this.
As I understood United We Stand, which is your best case, Congress is a non-agency. Congress requested documents, and we held that the part of the response that revealed what Congress asked for was protected.
Yes.
Right? And that was because Congress was not an agency. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So if I give you, for the purposes of this discussion, that if the President or anybody in the White House office or anybody in the OVP, because they're direct advisors to the President, requested any information derived from that would be an agency. How does that get you to the next step, which is really the question Judge Tatel asks? Somebody just enters the overall White House complex without anybody from the White House office giving any information at all to the Secret Service. Say, for example, they're meeting with the OMB people, or they're meeting with, I don't know, somebody else in the new executive office building that is not a WHO. How does that information become non-agency information?
It does for the following reason, Your Honor. The White House Access Control System is a single system that's administered uniformly, and for good reason. The Secret Service doesn't necessarily know whom the visitor is going to see. He might be seeing multiple people, perhaps in the same meeting. So there's one system covering one perimeter, and it's administered uniformly. And there's really no practical way of bifurcating these records or establishing separate systems. And for that reason, the assertion of control covers all these records, which does not leave a FOIA plaintiff in the lurch with respect to these FOIA entities. All the FOIA plaintiff needs to do, if he wants to get that information from the FOIA entities in EOP, is to submit a FOIA request directly to those FOIA entities like OMB. But the question is, can a plaintiff obtain the information directly from the Secret Service? And the answer should be no, because it's one system administered uniformly, and there's one MOU covering the entire system for good reason.
Well, but you can't have I assume that you're not saying just because there is an MOU, any document that the President says he controls becomes a non-agency document.
Correct. That is
not saying
that's
that.
Not our position today, Your Honor. I'm sure we can all imagine.
When you say today, you mean it might be your position another day? If
Your
we
Honor,
give you this case, will it be your position in the next case?
Your Honor, we agree wholeheartedly that there could be circumstances in which an MOU is merely an empty vessel, a sham that was written in order to circumvent the FOIA, but that's not this case. The MOU here is entirely sensible and reasonable.
My question is whether it covers only agency, non-agency records, or whether it also covers a. I'm not suggesting it's a sham or anything like that. The question is it too broad to cover, if it tries to cover all entrances to a complex which contains something that Congress has expressly said is an agency?
Yeah, no, I understand the concern, but it's not too broad because, again, this is one single system that it would not be feasible or practical to try to bifurcate the system or divvy up the records. So when you have a case—
Well, by not disclosing who they met with and only disclosing the fact that they passed through the outer barrier, as I take it that the ACR system does, it only discloses the fact the person left the entire complex. It doesn't disclose who they
That's
met,
right, Your Honor.
How is that, and assuming that the ACR system is not initiated by any call from the President or any advisor, it's just an electronic record of passing out of the entire building, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So how is that just that? I understand your argument about waves, or at least a part of waves. I'm not sure I understand the argument about ACR.
Well, a few things. One, of course, there's the MOU, which I promised not to mention
That was only in response to that one.
Okay, so I'll mention it now then. We have the MOU here, which unambiguously asserts control over all the WAX records, including the ACRs.
If the MOU asserted control over the entrance to the Treasury Department, would we have to respect that as being a non-agency record?
Well, I would not want to lightly disregard an MOU between the White House and the Department of the Treasury in light of the presumption of regularity, but certainly that would
be. It's not a question of presumption of regularity. This is just a question of what effect it's given. I'm not in any way suggesting it's a sham or it's improper in that sense. Imagine it was HUD. Imagine the White House sent a letter or made an agreement with the Federal Protective Service for HUD, H-U-D, saying that all, in fact, and said that all records in HUD, every single document in HUD, is under the control of the President because, by the way, there's a unitary executive. Constitution only mentions the President. So all the documents in HUD are presidential records.
Yeah, I'm willing to agree. I'm willing to agree that would not work, Your Honor,
okay.
Because in that case, it really does appear as if that MOU is an empty, as an overreach, to say the least.
But it has to have something to do with the President's authority that you're arguing here and making a separation of powers-like argument that the President should have authority to decide who he or she meets with and that shouldn't be disclosed immediately before or immediately after, right?
That is certainly one concern, but I wouldn't want to limit the test that narrowly. I think ultimately it should be a very deferential reasonableness test to see whether the MOU is one that should be upheld. And in a case like this one, in which there certainly is a very strong White House nexus, in which the Secret Service has no ongoing interest warranting retention in these records, and records
which
the Secret
Congress made a specific decision to require, to subject the Secret Service to FOIA.
That is correct, Your Honor. But the Congress also made a very conscious decision to exempt the President and the Vice President from the FOIA. And here we have this great.
The question we're trying to get to with you here is, where do you draw that? Assuming we agree with you, we've got to draw a line somewhere. Don't we want to draw it in a way that provides the protection the President needs, but also is faithful to FOIA, which Congress, as I said, has subjected the Secret Service to? And under your approach, you're essentially disregarding the interests of FOIA.
Absolutely.
Not balancing one against the other.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. A couple things about that, if I may. One, if there is a balancing, it should be done deferentially in light of the constitutional concerns and in light of the presumption of regularity. I agree there should be some deferential.
Well, then I go back to the point about people who are simply coming to the White House. I'll accept your argument that we are to be deferential about that, but I still don't understand, even with deference, why you would protect the simple fact of who goes in and out of the White House.
Let me try a different angle on that one then, because I can understand the resistance that Your Honor is feeling on this score. Your Honor, the timing of the visits, as well as the number of the visits, is very sensitive information. And a plaintiff might be able to infer, not always correctly perhaps, but might be able to infer with whom the visitor is meeting based upon the timing of the visits, based on who the visitor is, but even if there's some ambiguity on who the recipient of the visitor was. The number of visits and the timing of the visits conveys information, and that's precisely why the plaintiff wants this. And let's look at it through a different angle. Let's say the President was told from Congress, the White House complex cannot receive any visitors unless on a daily basis you publish a list of all the people who visited the White House complex. Surely that hypothetical law would at least raise some constitutional concerns. Maybe in the end one could disagree on whether it's a constitutional problem, but at the very least that hypothetical law raises concerns. Well, this case presents essentially the analog of that hypothetical law, even if you're talking about the ACRs, which doesn't contain the name of the recipient. The information we're talking about, Your Honor, is quintessentially White House information. The ACRs are records that pertain to activities at the White House. The Secret Service uses and reviews this on the grounds of the White House.
I understand. Can I switch gears here and ask you about the Vice President's residence for just a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
The affidavit from the Vice President's Chief of Staff says, in many, if not most cases, the reason for a visit is not apparent from the face of such records, nor is the relationship of the visitor to the vice president, his family, or OVP staff. So, based on that affidavit, what's the harm in releasing that information?
Your Honor,
it says specifically under oath that it will reveal nothing.
It doesn't say that, Your Honor. What it says is that many times the purpose is not clear. But even assuming the purpose is not clear, the mere identity of the visitor is very useful information. If plaintiff were to find
out... That's why people want it.
Pardon?
That's exactly why people want it.
And that's
just
why it's sensitive information.
Doesn't mean it's exempt from FOIA.
That's not a position, Your Honor. But it's with this information, Your Honor, even if the purpose of the visit itself is not clear, with this information, finding out how many visits a person makes or when a visit occurs allows an individual to chart the course of internal policy deliberations. It allows someone to get a detailed chronicle of the sources of information and advice. And sure, the record does not say this person met with respect to this law or that law, but by matching up the time of the visit with when a law was enacted, you can figure out perhaps who was asserting influence on the administration. Mm-hmm. By looking at the number of visits, even if you don't know the purpose of each
that
visit.
That seems to me to be such quintessentially public information in a democracy.
Your Honor.
Who's influencing the White House? Isn't that the kind of information that FOIA is supposed to, I don't have the quote here, but FOIA is designed to ensure that the people will know what their government is doing.
What the agencies are doing, and Congress expressly exempted
Excuse
the president.
It says, I think it says government.
But in the context, it's referring to the agencies, of course. FOIA applies to agencies, and Congress expressly exempted the president and the vice president.
And expressly subjected the Secret Service to FOIA.
Which is the conundrum we're in, and the question is then, how do we construe this ambiguity? And in light of the constitutional concerns, Your Honor, this Court should construe this ambiguity so as to avoid the constitutional...
If we conclude that United We Stand is applicable, there we held that where the non-agency causes the creation of the document that is, for whatever period of time, in the hands of the agency, what is exempted is what the directing non-agency expressed its intent to control. Before the memorandum of understanding, I'm still not real clear on what your evidence is as to the expression of intent to control on the part of the non-agency executive.
Your Honor, admittedly, we don't have, if you ignore the MOU, of course, we have nothing as clear as that.
All the documents at issue here are pre-MOU.
With respect, I think they're seeking everything before the day of the FOIA request, so it would cover that five-month period as well. But, Your Honor, I don't think, with respect, this Court should subject communications between the President and the Secret Service to the same level of formality and exactness that you have in United We Stand, which concerns communications between Congress.
Judge Staten and I are very familiar with what you're concerned, but that isn't answering my question. You're telling me what we shouldn't subject. What I asked you for is what is it we should look at to find that intent.
And what we have are the declarations, Your Honor, which reveal that there was an understanding, granted not in writing. There's nothing in writing aside from the declarations in the MOU.
What they're really telling us is about the subjective intent, at best, the subjective intent of the non-agency, without giving us objective evidence of the intent to control.
There's no objective evidence in writing, aside, of course, from the declaration of the MOU. But again, my point is this, Your Honor. The Secret Service and the President are inextricably intertwined, and they're joined at the hip. They interact all the time. It simply wouldn't make sense with respect to require them to have this formality, to put their understandings in writing. They interact almost every second of every day. They shouldn't be forced to put these agreements and understandings in. If they understand something and they agree to it and it's indisputed between them, Your Honor, they shouldn't be
forced. How do we reconcile that with our case law, which says, case after case, United We Stand and all the others, that the agreement has to be explicit and contemporaneous? We have at least three cases that say that.
I can reconcile it in two separate ways. First, those cases deal with communications between Congress.
And Congress's interest here you suggested in response to an earlier question that maybe Congress's interest isn't as strong as the president's, but you have separation of powers at stake there also, plus you have the congressional oversight element. So, I mean, it seems to me you're not going to be able to, make a, you can, I think you can probably make a good case that the president's interest here is equivalent to Congress's. I mean, we essentially said that in McGee, however you pronounce that, McGee. But I don't think you can make the case that it's stronger.
Let me try two different ways. Uh-huh. And the first one I'll try again along the same lines we're talking about.
Sure.
The second one takes it in a different direction. With respect to the line we're talking about, I would say the president's interest is not stronger. I'd say there's a different distinction, though.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Congress and an executive branch agency might be expected to have communications in writing, I don't think it makes sense to have the same expectation with respect to the president and the Secret Service. A different default rule, I think, should apply in light of the constant interactions the Secret Service has with the president. So it's not a stronger interest, but a different default rule in light of the reality of their relationship.
Well, the joint committee it was involved in United We Stand has daily routine communications with Treasury and IRS.
We're still dealing with two separate agencies that aren't joined to the hip. They're not inextricably intertwined. But let me try a second tack. I think the first argument is still correct. Let me try a different one. United We Stand and Paisley and Holy Spirit did require what they called a contemporaneous manifestation of control. But what do they mean by contemporaneous? In those cases, the assertions of control, they were deemed to be post hoc, postdated both the FOIA request and the lawsuit. In this case, the MOU predates the FOIA request and the lawsuit, and it applies not just to current records, but to prospective records. It's not simply some sort of post hoc manifestation. It's the reality, the ongoing reality of the relationship between the White House and the Secret Service. And Holy Spirit, just focusing on that one case which is cited in United We Stand, Holy Spirit said it declined to adopt the test that Congress had to assert control when the records are transferred to the agency. It rejected, declined to adopt that test. It also said on page 841, I believe, that Congress could reassert control over records, and the relevant question is whether a FOIA request was made at the time during which the records were subjected to a congressional assertion of control. Well, certainly, if you can reassert control after control is lost, then in this case, you're allowed to assert control before the FOIA request is made. That's the operative question under tax analysts and Kissinger and United We Stand. Was the FOIA request made at a time during which there was an assertion of control? And here, indisputably, the answer is yes. The FOIA request was made in October of 2006, a good 5 months after the assertion of control in the MOU, and that MOU reflects the previous understanding and the past practice, and the Secret Service has no ongoing interest in these records warranting retention, and the only reason why they have these records at all, Your Honor, is the protective statute, the only purpose of which.
What's your response to the amicus brief's description of the value of obtaining these documents? It says the proficiency and effectiveness of federal security agencies is a matter of substantial public interest. And they give examples of news coverage of the Park Service, the Secret Service, including the security of the White House, which they would not be able to do under your theory.
Your Honor, I don't think these records really show any useful information regarding the Secret Service. But even if they did, assuming arguendo, there's some marginal value, mm-hmm. that doesn't change either the analysis under United We Stand, of course, which does not concern the substance of the records, nor does this affect the totality of the circumstances test, which doesn't apply here because of the MOU. But even if the totality test did apply here, the interest that one might have in how the Secret Service is doing their job doesn't affect the overall calculus of the totality. This case, again, Your Honor, in addition to the MOU, we're dealing with quintessentially White House records which show White House activities. We're dealing with records in which the Secret Service has no ongoing interest warranting retention, and which the Secret Service has only because of that unique statute.
The idea of what it shows about Secret Service's activities consistent with precedent under FOIA in general, does not come into play at the stage of determining whether a record is obtainable. Under FOIA, it comes in usually when you get to the exemption stage. When you're balancing, for example, privacy interests against public interest, then you might look at what it reveals and what the nature of the plaintiff's or the requester's interest is. But ordinarily, when you're deciding in the first instance whether a document is subject to FOIA, you don't ask that question, what does it reveal or what are they looking for? You just ask if it's an agency record. So should we really be considering that yet at this stage?
No, only to the extent of this, Your Honor, and ultimately it's not. But I think the fact that these records really show what the White House is doing and not the Secret Service, it underscores two things. Number one, it explains why the White House and the Secret Service would agree that the White House should have control. It makes sense. The assertion of control makes sense in light of what these documents do or do not reveal. And second, the separation of powers, the constitutional concerns, the fact that these records show what the White House is doing, quintessential White House activities, explains why you have constitutional concerns with this information. Even without the purpose of a particular visit being known, with this information, a FOIA plaintiff can piece together a detailed chronicle of sources of information and advice.
But see, under that rationale, you could justify a memorandum of understanding of the kind Judge Garland described with HUD.
No, Your Honor,
yes,
because
it would be exactly the same.
No, it would not be.
You could piece all of this together, you could get these documents, and from them you could tell exactly what the White House was thinking at what time and how it was evolving its policy considerations regarding housing.
Your Honor, the HUD documents would not reveal a list of every single visitor to the White House complex and the VP's residence. The information here...
No, I'm talking about a memorandum of understanding that covered all White House-generated documents that are used by HUD. That could be used exactly the same way. You could, over the past couple weeks, with those documents, figure out exactly how the White House, presumably, or get some information about exactly how the White House was responding to the subprime mortgage issue. I mean, if that's the standard, then you really don't have a limiting principle at all.
We do. Let me try this one, Your Honor.
Okay.
Our point is not that an MOU is valid whenever the White House has an interest in some documents. Our point is that the White House here has more than just an interest in these documents. These documents are inextricably intertwined with the White House. It's a list of visitors to the White House. It's, according to plaintiffs, a list of those who are asserting influence on the White House. The ACRs, they're created on the grounds of the White House, pertaining to visits on the White House, activities in the White House, and are created at least in part by people in the White House. It's more than just a White House interest in these documents. You could not get more White House oriented than these documents. And that's why there's a difference in kind, at least a difference in degree, a significant difference in degree, between these records and the hypothetical HUD records. The question ultimately,
we're way over your time, and that's our fault, not yours.
Yeah, I actually have about three.
Then we'll be way over everybody.
I've been saving them up. So, just to go back to this idea that the part of United We Stand that seems to me is the strongest for you is the argument that the request comes from and reveals something about a non-agency, namely the White. And I'm going to use White House Office now as from now on, as a abbreviation for the president, the close advisors, and the vice president and his close advisors. So if we wanted to follow United We Stand as closely as possible, we would somehow redact from documents anything that revealed that part but not others. You respond, well, this creates a problem because anybody who enters the White House would then be, the White House complex would then be revealed, and somebody could piece together who was actually meeting with the president. Is there any way in which records of people who there is no chance are going to meet with anybody in the White House office and are instead going to meet with with agencies or with the groundskeepers or with the social office or anything like that could be revealed without revealing what you're concerned about? That is, if there is any kind of balancing going on here, it seems to me that at least your opening position requires us to throw out lots of documents that do not reveal anything either that is of concern to the president in any way, or that is really a non-agency record, in order to protect a small core, and I understand your point about that core. Is there any alternative you can offer for that? Now, let me just give an example. I don't think this probably works, but as an example. So this circuit has the Glomar Explorer rule, which arises out of a terrific case about Howard Hughes's boat. But the point of which was the CIA could answer, we neither admit nor deny that we have this document, because to admit or deny that we have this document might reveal something about it. So if somebody asks the CIA, is Mr. Cohn a secret agent? The CIA doesn't say, any document showing Mr. Cohn is a secret agent, CIA doesn't say, we don't have any documents, because that reveals he isn't. And the CIA doesn't respond that those documents are exempt, because that reveals that he is. Instead, it just says, we can't respond one way or the other on this kind of question. Do you see any compromise? I don't mean in the sense of compromising the law, but I'm talking about a way in which materials that seem, at least on their face, to be agency materials can be disclosed, while those that are of concern to you would be redacted.
Well, let's think about this and talk about this. If someone were to visit the White House, the WAVES record would indicate who made the request. The person who made the request would not always be the person that the visitor is coming to see. It could be an assistant or someone else.
That we can get over also. I understand. That seems relatively easy to get over. If the purpose is to visit somebody in the White House office, that's good enough. Those people are all the agents of people in the White House office. But what do we do with somebody who's coming to see the social secretary, coming to see the gardener, coming to see any elements of OMB that are in the old executive office building? What do we do with those people?
Well, let's start with the OMB example, because I think it's a little bit different from the gardener example. The OMB example, someone makes a visit, the request might be from someone in OMB, but the visitor might be going to see not just OMB, but the White House counsel's office, for instance, perhaps in the same meeting, perhaps in separate meetings, and you wouldn't know from the record. The record wouldn't tell you. So you wouldn't really have an idea by looking at the record. With respect to the gardener, it might be fair to assume that if Jerry Falwell was just going to visit the White House gardener, he was not influencing the White House, he was not meeting about policy. I don't know. That's a decision this court can make. But I think by and large, the reality of the records we're talking about, you wouldn't know, because it might show the request was made by OMB, but the visit might be to more than just OMB or vice versa.
So you're saying because it's not possible, no, we have to rule them all non-agency records?
I think this court should, for a couple reasons, Your Honor. One, of course, is the MOU, which sensibly asserts control over the entire system. It's one system that can't be bifurcated, at least not without difficulty. One MOU, one perimeter, one system.
Is it not the case that people enter, if they're entering the West Wing through another, or the residence through another entrance?
Pardon?
If someone's coming to see the president at the residence, isn't there a separate visitor entrance there?
If someone comes in, for example, just through the motorcade, there wouldn't be a WAVES record. And for some personal visits to the residence, I believe there might be some special ushers list, and you would not have to be ferried through WAVES. But by and large, I mean, the records that we're talking about are the WAVES and the ACR records. And there is one single system for all of those records.
Right, but I'm asking, are there separate gates for people coming to see high advisors?
Generally, no. I mean, there are separate gates, of course, into the White House, but you don't have necessarily one gate if you're seeing Advisor X and a separate gate for Advisor Y.
Where you're entering the compound, there's a limited number of gates.
And those gates, those are exactly, and through all those gates, you have the WAVES and the ACR system. On the outer margins that I mentioned, if you're going through the motorcade or some personal visit, there might be, in those unique circumstances, some special method. But aside from those idiosyncratic cases, irrespective of what gate you come through, it's the WAVES ACR.
No, I understand that, but is there something indicated by which, in other words, if we take the point I think either Judge Taylor or Judge Sentell mentioned, which is maybe we would presume that somebody who's visiting the vice president at the residence is coming to visit somebody in that office. Is there a particular entrance at the White House complex that would give a presumption that might not apply to the entrance on 17th Street?
I don't think so. And speaking partially from personal experience, there's one entrance, for example, I guess it's the south entrance you go through. And if you turn right, you're entering the West Wing. If you turn left, you're entering the OEOB. And you wouldn't know from the record just where you entered. You wouldn't know from the entry point.
Don't you have to have a particular kind of authority to enter at that entrance? Not just any visitor gets in that entrance, right?
You need to have a request, I believe, from someone in the West Wing to get into the West Wing, but I don't believe the waves or ACRs would indicate that.
What about someone visiting, entering the East Wing? That would be quite unlikely, wouldn't it, to have anything to do with the President or the Vice President?
Aside from the tours, I assume you're talking about, right, someone entering the East Wing. Again, as far as I understand it, you don't have any separate records or anything that would allow you to distinguish precisely who they're going to see.
But you could have
the requester, which might give you an idea.
You would know that X group all came in through the East Wing. That you would know. Right?
Again, aside from the requester information,
doesn't the record reveal what entrance, where the entrance was made?
That's what this thing they...
So imagine we had a rule. I'm not saying we would have this rule, but imagine we had a rule that entrances through the entrance to the East Wing or entrances through the South Gate can be presumed to be visits with the White House office. And therefore, those documents are non-agency records. You wouldn't have to look at the document. All you'd have to do is know that it was for someone who entered through one of those entrances.
I don't think that would cover the whole domain, Your Honor, because, for instance, the OEOB, you have White House offices, like many of the associate White House counsels, perhaps all of them work in the OEOB, and OMB officials also work in the OEOB. Someone who's making an entrance into OEOB might be to see a White House office, or might be,
but how difficult, maybe put it another way, a lot of what you've said in your briefs and understand are how burdensome a system would be that somehow had to try to avoid the Secret Service altogether in order to protect the President's schedule. What if the question were, if the person were coming at any point in their visit to be permitted to see somebody in the White House office, those people would enter through the South Gate, or those people, if they were visiting the President personally, would enter through the East, and that any document generated by that kind of visit or an exit of such a person would not be an agency record?
I guess going forward, the Secret Service could redesign the system. I'm not sure if that would be a wise way of doing the security, but I guess it could possibly be done. But with respect to the past, you wouldn't know from these records because, again, for instance, somebody might...
I understand the point about the past, but now you have me thinking about the future just for a moment. With respect...
Your Honor, this is a hazardous endeavor to figure out the proper security arrangements for the White House.
Yeah, well, that's a burden that you're entitled to express. That's the kind of that's what I'm asking you to say. That's what you think is correct.
And honestly, it would be not I, but the Secret Service who could best explain why we should not have some entrances that would indicate White House visits and other entrances for non-White House visits. And the answer might be, just hypothetically speaking, that if the world knew that a particular entrance was for the White House,
right,
that would
be... That's the kind of... The factual question I was asking to think about. Now, what about just indicating when the person comes in at the main? That is, if we know that the person is coming for a visit to the President, that all records about that person couldn't be disclosed. This is separate from Judge Tatel's suggestion about anybody who can just stand on 17th Street. Imagine instead the rule were, following a Glomar Explorer kind of theory, that if the person is coming to visit somebody in the White House office, those records can't be disclosed. If they are coming to visit somebody not in the White House office, and therefore part of an agency, mm-hmm, those records can be disclosed.
I guess one problem is you wouldn't know by looking at the record whom they're going to see. You might know who made the request from the waves, but you wouldn't know who they're going to see. And someone might have had the request from an OMB official, but ultimately sees a whole bunch of people, including the White House counsel's office. So at least with respect to the past, and the future might be different, but with respect to the past, you wouldn't know looking at these records whom the visitor's coming to see.
Okay, one last question. Has this never arisen before? I mean, in the entire history since FOIA, has no one ever requested, until this, the couple cases right before this case, nobody ever made a FOIA request for visitors to the White House complex?
Before, not just this case, but
yes.
Washington Post.
Yeah.
The institutional memory before this administration is not entirely clear, but we do know that at least in some cases, the Secret Service rejected FOIA requests that were directed to Waves and ACRs on the theory they lacked control, and they suggested the requester go to the archivist. I'm not saying that was the consistent practice before this administration.
I'm talking about real time, not that is not from, information about a previous administration.
No, that was during it, during the Clinton administration.
Okay, to go to the archivist?
They said go to the archivist, and this is not on the record. It's something
and that was Secret Service's response. That was Secret Service.
Correct, Your Honor. The Secret Service says we don't have control over these records.
They say Treasury at that time.
And there's no litigation you know about before this flurry of cases?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I think we've used more time on the first advocate than we had set aside for the entire case. But that's
the entire
our
morning.
That's not your fault.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Ann Wiseman, and I represent the plaintiff appellee, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW. Let me pick up on some of the focus that this Court has had in the last few questions. I think one of the premises of the government's argument here is that simply because the President and Vice President have a concern about revealing information, that that's sufficient to bypass the FOIA altogether and the exemption process for addressing any constitutionally protected interests.
If it is a presidential document, or if these are presidential documents, then they're correct. We do bypass FOIA, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but in order to get to that definitional point, in part what the government is arguing is that this court should treat these records as presidential, not agency, because of these constitutional concerns that are sort of lurking in the background. But
they're not that far in the background. I mean, if you were coming in here asking for the President to report what persons he had called upon for advice, you would concede that raises constitutional questions. I'm not asking you to concede what the decision would be on those questions, but just as Justice Kennedy wrote in the separate opinion in Public Citizen, that is a separation of powers problem. If Congress or the courts were to try to force the President to say from whom he sought advice, wouldn't that?
From whom he sought advice, and that's where I was going, Your Honor, precisely, which is to say that any protection here has to be within the confines of executive privilege, as this circuit and the Supreme Court have recognized it.
Well, it's not even phrased as executive privilege. You never get to the point of having to claim a privilege if it's invading the constitutional prerogatives of another branch of government. Isn't Kennedy correct that at least raised? I'm not asking you for a decision. The Supreme Court hadn't even decided the question, but isn't it pretty plain that such a question exists? They're not dreaming one up.
Such a question may exist. I agree with you, Your Honor, but here's the point. The FOIA has always been recognized. The exemptions to the FOIA, and in particular Exemption 5, have always been the avenue that this Court has used to accommodate those constitutional interests.
We rarely have a case where we're directly dealing with that constitutional question. We don't get to the enumerated exemptions.
Yes, Your Honor, but there are at least two cases I'd like to draw your attention to. One is Ryan, in which this Court said expressly that had the records in question been requested by White House staff, they would not be subject to the FOIA. Ryan involved a situation where the President had asked the Attorney General for advice on judicial nominees, and to fulfill that, the Attorney General sent out a questionnaire to a group of senators and got their responses, and a FOIA request was filed with the Justice Department for those responses. And the argument was made that they are not agency records. And this Court disagreed, and again, it made the express point that it would have been the case that they would not have been agency records if the questionnaires had been sent out by White House aides, top White House aides. But in that case, that wasn't the case.
Well, one thing that was said in Ryan, which is really a precursor to United We Stand, was that there was no indication from the senators that they wished to limit the Attorney General's use, suggesting that that might be different. And in United We Stand, the Court held, two members of which are on this panel, that, so I'm the only person who doesn't know what that case is about. that the fact that the Congress asked for the information with the implication of control coming from that, meant that that part of the document was a non-agency record. We did not require any assertion of the exemption. So how do you deal with that problem?
I think United We Stand has to be viewed in the specific context of a congressional request, and here is why. Unlike the executive branch, under the unitary executive theory that this court accepted in Judicial Watch v. Department of Energy, the confidentiality of Congress's oversight function cannot be protected under the FOIA. Exemption 5 applies only to interagency communications.
Well, but we held in Judicial Watch that even though the exemption applies only to interagency, even though the word agency was in the exemption, it applied to a non-agency, right? It applied to information provided to the task force.
Yes, but what the reasoning and the rationale of that decision was under a unitary executive theory, the president and the advisory committee were all part of the executive branch, and that
but
is
here we have. Here we have one, if we accept this argument, you know, this theory for purposes of this argument, we have the president, who Congress said is not an agency, and who has control over agencies, saying, I want to continue to control this document. It's not apparent to me why the president's effort to assert control should be weaker than a different branch's effort to assert control over a different branch. That is, Congress was trying to assert control in United We Stand over an independent branch of the government. Here, under the theory you're mentioning, the president is trying to assert control over his own branch of the government. Why? If anything, it would seem to me that would go the other way, that it would be stronger for the president to assert control than it would be for an independent branch.
Well, I think the question is, there are two things there, Your Honor. With all due respect, I think you're confusing a little bit an assertion of an intent to control and whether or not there's a process by which the president can otherwise protect his interests.
Well, let me ask this point blank. Do you think, is your view that these documents are covered by Exemption 5?
We don't know yet. And
no,
I have
that's
to stress.
That's not going to be an acceptable answer
okay,
today.
Okay, but can I explain procedurally why it is we don't know?
Yeah, imagine, but is your, can you give me an example of any situation in which who the person is going to visit is alone sufficient from your point of view to establish an executive
yes.
privilege or a privileged communication?
I think a good example would be when the court is considering nominees to the Supreme Court, and potential nominees
what
are
you
invited.
Mean the president is considering.
The president
yes.
is. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
The way it's done.
If the president were considering nominees to the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. and a small number of individuals were invited to the White House so the president could interview them personally, I can well imagine that just by revealing who visited the president in that window of time would reveal something confidential about his deliberations.
Right, fair enough. So that you're really on the same wavelength as your opponent. So your opponent says the president is considering this week decisions about subprime market and a disclosure that mortgage bankers came into the White House would reveal that maybe someone in the White House is talking to them about that subject. Would you say that they would be excluded as well?
Not necessarily.
Why is that different than the Supreme Court?
I think, again, we have to go back. What I tried to start out with at the beginning was an emphasis on what exactly is protected here. I don't think the White House has the ability to draw a curtain around the building.
No, I'm asking about the exemption issue.
Well, I think the exemption issue, first of all, proves why it is that you needn't bypass FOIA to accommodate these
interests.
Well,
it doesn't prove it unless the only example you can give us is the Supreme Court example.
I think we'd have to, the government would have to meet its burden, which it has not yet done here, in perfecting a claim of exemption.
So that would mean that the president wouldn't know until afterwards whether who he met with would be disclosed, right? He could not guarantee confidentiality to somebody who he wanted to meet with because he wouldn't know until afterwards.
I think it's a very simple matter for the president and the White House. All they would have to do when they send over information that goes into a Secret Service visitor record, which would be to have a box that is checked that says, this is a confidential visit, not to be disclosed. So on a going forward basis,
and you would accept that?
Well, we might still want to challenge it under the FOIA, but there's no question that it would alleviate the burden that really forms the core of their argument.
But it wouldn't alleviate the concern about knowing in advance whether that visit would really be protected, right? Because you would challenge it. Imagine in this case they had checked off the boxes of the 9 people you're interested in. You wouldn't accept that, would you?
We may not, Your Honor.
No, you wouldn't.
On
no, you would not, right?
Okay.
You're not willing to say that if we say that these are agency records, that you're going to accept an argument below that they're exempt.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I don't understand that why, as a constitutional matter, that's unacceptable. Because the heart of the government's constitutional claim here is the burden that it would impose on the White House.
The constitutional claim is that one branch of government, two other branches of government, are invading a separate branch. I don't understand what you don't understand.
I think it's hard to reconcile that with this court's holding in Judicial Watch v. Department of Energy. And if I may, let me explain.
I'm not sure that I immediately see the relevance of Judicial Watch.
Let me see if I can.
Go ahead.
Let me see if I can make it clearer to Your Honor. You may, as I'm sure you're aware, that involved a FOIA request where the specific documents that the requesters were seeking were documents that would expose the internal deliberations of a presidential task force. Those same plaintiffs had also filed a Federal Advisory Committee Act lawsuit in which they sought discovery directly from the vice president on the related topic. And this court, following Supreme Court ruling, held that, you know, it granted the government's petition for mandamus on the rationale that those documents, that it would impose an undue burden to request directly on the vice president that discovery. But in the Supreme Court decision, it made clear that if the plaintiff had not been the vice president, it would be a different situation altogether. So then let's turn to the FOIA lawsuit, which is proceeding at the precisely same time. Unsuccessful in their effort to get the documents under discovery, they filed a FOIA request of the agencies whose agency heads had participated directly in the task force. And neither this court nor the government ever suggested, much less found, that there was anything constitutionally infirm about that request. In fact, that was the case where the government came in and said, under a unitary executive theory, the communications between the White House and the agency are protected. It may not be, I think it's the flip side of this case, and I don't see how you can reconcile that whole thing.
The concern here is whether there is an invasion of separation of powers. And you don't seem to be willing to acknowledge that that's the concern, and I'm not sure I understand what your resistance is.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's certainly not my – I understand that that is the concern they have raised. I mean, our argument, among other things, is that it is entirely premature, and here's why. At this point, the agency has not even processed the request. We don't even know if there are visitor records. We don't know what the volume is. We don't know what they relate to.
Well, if they're correct, that these are what – use the general term we've been using – White House presidential office documents, you're not entitled to any of them. Right?
I don't agree, Your Honor. I think we are entitled to what
we
is not.
We're back on the same circle, and you're not acknowledging that there's a separation of powers
no,
problem?
Our point is that Exemption 5 exists.
You don't get to Exemption 5 if the separation of powers precludes us from treating this as FOIA documents in the first place.
But our mere objection to Exemption 5 does not mean the documents will be disclosed.
But that was the same argument made in the Cheney case.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court overruled a number of the members of this court on exactly that point, that the fact that the assertion could be made of privilege in discovery or that discovery could be rejected wasn't good enough when it cut that close. How do you distinguish that argument?
It's what I
that,
said.
That opinion.
I'm sorry.
How do you distinguish the Supreme Court's opinion?
It's what I said earlier. The Supreme Court was very careful to say the critical factor here is that the vice president is a party, and it will be directed to the vice president. And the Supreme Court went on to say if this vice president were not the party, that might be a different case. And I think we have – otherwise, I think the consequences of this court finding that these records are not agency records, I think it sets us down.
Suppose we find – they are agency records, but there's information on them that can be protected. That's what we did in United We Stand.
That's good.
And the reason I ask you that question is I want to ask you to focus on what I think is so unusual about this case, and I didn't really see you dealing with in the brief. The government says no one could get under FOIA the president's daily calendar, right?
That's correct. That's okay. The government's argument.
Well, but that's true.
And they concede it, yes. Okay. We've never argued
okay, so
that we can't
then
file.
Then they say, but look, okay, because the president of the United States and the vice president of the United States by law have to have Secret Service protection, you're attempting to get indirectly what you can't get directly. That's their argument. And, I mean, I think Congress would be quite surprised to think that by requiring the president to have Secret Service protection, they are opening his personal calendars to being obtained under FOIA.
This court has rejected applying a test where the content of the document controls whether or not it is an agency record. That, I think, is the teaching of Bryan.
Look, I mean, what do you say about the basic argument here? That can't be the response to it. I mean, the fact is that these daily calendars are not obtainable under FOIA, yet they would be under your theory of the case. And I'm only talking about that. Put that in the context of my question about the documents themselves being agency documents and subject to FOIA, but this piece of information, or any information that would lead to it, is not obtainable.
The information may not be obtainable because it's exempt under Exemption 5.
I don't think Exemption 5 under my...
I understand.
I want to know why...
I'm not trying to avoid your question.
You don't deal with this in the brief, and I'd really like to know what the answer is, because it's what bothers me most about this case. From your point of view.
Okay, so that piece of information, This court has never held that a document can be parsed where part of the information is the presidential record.
That's exactly what we said. We said it was, in fact, the dissent in United We Stand took the position you were.
But there's another statutory...
Do you agree with that?
United
We Stand, we did exactly what I suggested. We called part of the document not an agency document. And I'm just asking you again, I really want you to deal with this question of the Secret Service. And how do you get around that? What do you deal with this seems to be compelling argument that it is only through the happenstance that the President of the United States is required to have Secret Service protection that you're able to get this particular piece of information under FOIA?
I think you can, outside of the presidential context, you can cite to any number of instances where records are created only because of the statute.
There's no instance in government like this. There's only two people who have to have Secret Service protection.
Yes, that's true.
The president and the vice president.
But at the same time that the government, that the president and vice president are required to accept Secret Service protection, the Secret Service, which is an agency and which is subject to FOIA, is given a statutory mandate to provide that protection. It's a unique case, yes, but your question ignores the other half of the equation, which is that these are records that are created by agency employees
You're ignoring my question by stating that.
I think that if this court were to say here that these are not presidential records, I'm sorry, that these are presidential records and not agency records.
What do you mean by these?
These secret White House visitor records.
Answer my question in the context of my question, which is that they are agency records disclosable under FOIA, but not the information about, nothing that would reveal who they're visiting.
The reason I'm struggling, Your Honor, and I want to define it even more,
nothing that would indicate whether they're visiting the president or the vice president or their close advisors. Everything else you can get.
But not who the president visited, no matter what the circumstances.
You can get all the information you want. I'm just trying this out. Under my theory, you would be able to get all the information you want about how often these people go to the White House and when they go to the White House. They would just delete any information that would allow you to draw a conclusion that they're meeting with the president. That's all.
Well, I'm not going to concede that.
No, I'm sure you won't.
No, but...
But I want you to answer that question, not the question, not the government's argument, which is you can't get anything.
Well...
The government's theory is, as you said, you draw a curtain over the White House.
Right.
That wasn't my question.
It's certainly one way that this court could come out, given the unique circumstances of this case. I still think there's problems reconciling that with the language of the Presidential Records Act, which Congress is not subjected to, and which is, I think, a distinguishing feature between this case and United We Stand America. And here's why. The Presidential Records Act defines presidential records specifically as excluding agency records, documentary materials that come into the possession of the agency. And this circuit in Armstrong made clear that what Congress was doing there was saying that the FOIA's definition of agency records trumps the Presidential Records Act, and went on to say the reason for that is, yes, Congress recognized it could not subject the President and Vice President directly to the FOIA, but it's not because Congress believed that they were entitled to have absolute confidentiality in what they were dealing. It was instead a recognition of the daily burdens that imposing a FOIA regime would place on the on the President and Vice President. I need to be very specific here. On the other hand, though, Congress said through the Presidential Records Act, they were also acknowledging the interest that the FOIA serves in transparency and open government. And I think that is why this is different from United We Stand America, because this court has to reconcile any outcome here. It has to be consistent with not only the FOIA, but also the Presidential Records Act.
Can I ask you, I asked opposing counsel the HUD question because I wanted to know what the implication would be for broader kind of assertion. So I want to ask you the same question. If we were to rule in your favor, what would we rule the next day if the newspapers requested on a daily basis all records of, one, all visitors to the White House, and two, all visitors to the White House office?
If we ruled
in your favor in this case that these are agency records, would the same be true of a broad request for anybody who visited the White House office, that is, the President's advisors?
Just on your description of the request, yes, it would have to carry over. And I'm anticipating your next question, and I, with all due respect, if I'm wrong, I hope you will tell me. If the concern is
I'm happy to have you ask yourself the questions.
Provided you answer that question.
If the concern is that we would be facing a very different burden than we're facing by the kind of request the crew has made, which is a request for a much more discreet request for the records of 9 individuals. I think those kinds of burden claims are dealt with at the agency and district court level all the time in the FOIA context.
But wouldn't the President have to expect, if we ruled in your favor, that these kind of requests would come soon after, and that whenever the President met with anyone, they wouldn't know, pending a decision about burden, whether that disclosure would be confidential? That's really the same question I asked you before, I guess.
Right, and I do think that the process I proposed would be very workable for the White House. I think if they noted at the time it's confidential, then they would have a reasonable expectation that it would be protected. But I think, you know...
Why don't they have a reasonable expectation under the Memorandum of Understanding?
Well, the Memorandum of Understanding is flawed for several reasons. First, it's not just that it was created in May 2006, long after it was created not only after they had had requests from us and others, but also were in litigation over
maybe
the issue.
But as far as documents created after the Memorandum of Understanding, why isn't that at least as effective as that request for confidentiality that you are saying they should put on their email?
If you go back to Tax Analyst and its definition of what is an agency record, it has two components, created or obtained by the agency and under the agency's control. The Supreme Court in that case explained that the control factor is satisfied if the documents are created by agency employees doing agency business.
Imagine
when I enter my question.
And so, Your Honor, Yes, I'm trying.
Let's move to something that distinguishes the email with the box checked from the memorandum of understanding that applies to all the emails. What is the distinction?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, Your Honor.
Right. You were saying that the White House could have a box to check to say this is to be treated as confidential.
Yes.
The memorandum of understanding says all of those things that go to the White House calendar are confidential. Why is the email checked box any better than the memorandum of understanding?
Because it is much more narrowly tailored. Right now, the
That's a fact. That isn't a distinction that tells me why there is a difference in effect.
Because
it's more narrowly tailored. So what? Why is the more narrowly tailored, and it's not any more narrowly tailored, in fact, if you check the box every time, but why is the question of whether you do it one document at a time answered by saying it's more narrowly tailored? That's tautology.
No, because right now, if this court were to rule that these are not agency records, the court would be saying that the entire body of Secret Service White House visitor records are not agency records. That includes the visits to the chef. That includes visits to annual Christmas parties. That includes visits that the White House has already been very public
Somewhere
about.
Somewhere in here, are you going to compare the memorandum of understanding with the email box?
I am. The memorandum of understanding is much broader. It encompasses within it not just those visits.
Why is the broader any less effective than the narrower? If they check the box every time, that's effectively the same thing as a memorandum of understanding.
Well, certainly we count on a presumption of agency regularity, and we hope that the White House would not abuse that process, and that is why we think that it would still have to be subject to challenge under the Freedom of Information Act and Exemption 5.
I assume the government's response to your checkbox or suggestion would be that doesn't help at all, because anybody would know from anybody would know that everybody who had a box checked and therefore whose records weren't released had met with the president or the vice president, right?
I mean, that's a fair point, Your Honor. It seems to me, I mean, this court is obviously wrestling with a unique situation, and it's obviously wrestling with the fact that these records implicate, excuse me, presidential interests. All I'm making a plea for is that you acknowledge the other interests that the circuit has acknowledged before.
All my questions were based on these being agency documents.
And I think if this court finds that these are agency documents, that certainly both the Secret Service, the White House, and District Court, if necessary, can find a mechanism to
carve out. We've been trying to find what that is. And, you know, you keep talking about Exemption 5, yet both you and the amicus brief are very careful to say you're not sure Exemption 5 would cover it. I'm not even sure it would cover it. I've suggested a mechanism, which is, you know, resting on this extremely unique situation in this case, namely the requirement that the president have Secret Service protection. So I haven't heard from you a counter suggestion for how we can balance it. What you're basically saying is we should just affirm and somehow let the district court figure this out, but the only thing the district court would have is Exemption 5.
That's correct,
Your Honor. So what else is there? Is there any other, can you suggest any other mechanism for us?
By which this court could.
We have to write the opinion. What?
No, and I very much appreciate that.
Okay.
I can't, because the way that this court in the past has addressed the president's interests.
But we've never had a case like this.
You've never had a case with this factual situation.
Right.
I agree.
Yeah.
But
it's more than just facts. It's this odd legal situation we have with the Secret Service.
But the countervailing interest is that if you carve out this category of records, even if you look broadly at the entire universe of visitor records, and you say, we're only going to focus on this narrow subset, those records that pertain to the White House office, for example, as Judge Garland, as you suggested, or, you know, some other way, you are, at the outset, elevating the interest that the president has above all other, when it's not been demonstrated that kind of absolute confidentiality is needed. And that's what we fear. And that's, I think,
why aren't we, when you say elevating, I guess I'm not following why we're not leveling. That is, why we're not saying the president's interest is the same as the judiciary's and the same as the Congress's in our earlier cases.
Well, in this case, in this context, this court and the Supreme Court has addressed what the president's interests are and how far they go in the context of executive privilege, and made it clear that there is no
separation of powers applies to the judiciary and separation of powers applies to the Congress, and yet in both cases you said certain documents are not agency records, even when they're in the hands of an agency. So I have to say I'm a little bit stuck on this, on the United We Stand case, where we said even a part of a document wasn't an agency record because it would reveal something that an independent branch, in that case Congress, wanted confidential.
One way that I understand that opinion, this may not be correct, is that it's much like the attorney-client privilege, where if you have a document that's covered by it, and you have another document that reflects the same information, you can't order disclosure of that second document because you're essentially undermining that which
you're
making
an
protection.
Argument about. That would be an argument about an exemption, but the court did not consider it as an exemption argument. The court took the threshold point, which it was that it wasn't an agency document. Let me ask one more fact question, or maybe it's not really a fact question, just a more narrow question. You say that the MOU, because it occurred after the litigation began, mm-hmm. doesn't count. What are we to take from the fact that the Secret Service, at least during the Bush administration, had a policy of returning these records within 60 days? Doesn't that not reflect something consistent with the MOU?
You also have to take into account the actual practice of the agency. Uh-huh. And that is what the district court looked at in analyzing the agency record uh-huh. situation and said they've talked about legal control. Uh-huh. They claim that the White House has legal control. Uh-huh. And yet time and time again, the actual practice of the Secret Service was to the contrary.
It didn't return or overwrite the documents after 60 days?
That's correct. It did not. Not in every case. In fact, I mean, I think just last Friday, in a Rule 28J letter.
That was about documents at the OVP. I want to focus only on the WAVES record and the ACR record for a moment.
The Secret Service, in responding to other FOIA requests that predate this one, I know this because one of them was...
I want to know, did the district court find that the declaration, that the person who made the declaration about 60 days was lying?
No.
Then what happened?
The district court discounted the MOU as post hoc rationalization.
I understand that. I'm not asking about the MOU for the moment. Just about this, the practice of either overwriting the records, and therefore making them worthless, or returning them until the date of the archivist's intervention.
The district court found, looking at all the declarations, which were not lying, but were quite honest about the fact that there were multiple instances in which the records had not been transferred. There were instances where they still had copies on their own computers or paper documents. And so what the district court said was their actual practice was very inconsistent and muddled, both with respect to the records pertaining to president's visits and also to the vice president's residence. And I think that was an additional factor that led the district court to discount as absolutely controlling the memorandum of understanding and the intent. And I think that is a factual record that this court also obviously has to take into account as well. We have, on the one hand, a memorandum of understanding that was executed not only after the agency had received FOIA requests, but after the issue was joined in litigation. And on the
end for a moment, though, that the practice before the issuance of the memorandum of understanding had been precisely what the government argued it was. That is to say that all of the documents had been overwritten or turned back over. Would you say that was without effect as far as just determining the intent to control?
Under the precedent of this court, yes. This court has been very demanding in saying that the intent needs to be very specific and it needs to be contemporaneous. And I think under these circumstances,
I don't know though that we have said that you had to have a writing. We said it has. I don't know that we even said what you said. We said, but assuming we said that, have we said there has to be a writing, or would just other expressions of intent be sufficient?
Well, I think
there aren't that many cases. You state that this court has been very specific, as if there's some kind of history here. Outside United We Stand, there's not much.
I do understand that, Your Honor. I'm not trying to overstate what precedent there is, but it's not as if there's no precedent. And I believe it was in the Paisley case where Congress was advancing a generalized need for confidentiality in conducting its constitutionally based oversight function, and this court said that's just not enough. This court was sensitive to the constitutional interests that were implicated when Congress is exercising its oversight authority. But I think that's a good precedent here, because the court, even while recognizing those interests, did not go on to say that that means automatically that these are not agency records. Instead, it held those records to the same searching standard, which is there needs to be something specific.
If we had a checked box, it would be enough. But if we have an action totally consistent with a checked box, it's not enough.
I don't think under this precedent it is. And I think it's a very dangerous road to go down.
Let's talk to you also way past your assigned times, unless my colleagues have further questions, which they may.
No. I'm done.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give the government back 2 minutes for rebuttal. We'll probably talk you past that. But
if we're not talking,
you have to quit after 2 minutes.
I have only two arguments to make, Your Honor, the first of which concerns the sensitivity of the information here. The second concerns the MOU. On the sensitivity of the information, Judge Tatel suggested the possibility of deleting just the field of who requested the visit and leaving the rest.
No, that wasn't my question. My suggestion was you delete who they were meeting with.
Delete who they're meeting with, and then leaving the rest. For a couple reasons, Your Honor, that would not solve the problems here. The first is something I mentioned before. I'm not going to belabor it again, but the point about how the number of visits and timing of visits reveals information. Mm-hmm. But here's a second point, Your Honor. All that is an invitation to creativity. A future FOIA plaintiff would then redesign his request, for instance, to ask for documents from the vice president and his staff. And even if you deleted who the person visited, if the FOIA request is framed in those terms, the FOIA plaintiff would know who the person visited. And that's just not a hypothetical example, that's a real world example. The Washington Post case concerned such a FOIA request. So even if we delete the name of the recipient of the visitor, the WAVES record would still reveal very sensitive information.
I'm not following
that. That's not this case.
I didn't understand what the request was in that case. Could you just say it again?
Oh, I'm sorry. In the Washington Post case, the request was for the names of every person, every individual who met with the vice president and a dozen of his senior staff. The request was framed in those terms.
That seems like a case, if we follow Judge Tatel's point, which is the information about whether they met with is non-agency information, there would be no response under Judge Tatel's description of the theory.
There shouldn't be any response, but if we simply deleted the names of the recipients and gave the rest of the information.
That's like the Glomar problem. That would disclose by the production of the document that even though the document doesn't say there was a meeting, since it's a response to a question for all meetings, that would disclose.
Correct, Your Honor. I just wanted to make sure the court was aware of that.
We got that problem, but that's your only problem?
The other problem, of course, is the one that we've discussed previously about how the timing and number of visits also reveals information. For instance, the timing of visits matched up with a decision on a Supreme Court justice or matched up on a decision on the subprime lending crisis. The timing and number of visits is revealing, and that's why plaintiff wants the information. The second point I'd like to make concerns a memorandum of understanding. And before I get into this, I want to respond more completely to a question you asked about prior practice. My colleague informs me that previously there were a few instances in which the Secret Service, without talking to the White House or DOJ, did respond to a FOIA request or a few FOIA requests concerning ACRs. But with the memorandum of understanding—
In this administration or previously?
In this administration, there were a few occasions, Your Honor. But the memorandum of understanding clarifies—
It's not very powerful evidence of control, is it?
Your Honor, we have admitted in our briefs that some mistakes were made. This is one of those mistakes. And we're not saying the practice—
Is that in the passive tense?
Mistakes were made. That's a familiar phrase in this town.
By and large, though, the past practice was consistent with the mutual understanding, and that mutual understanding was memorialized by the MOU. And a couple things about the MOU. The MOU, at the very least, governs prospectively. The district court found the MOU to be irrelevant and disregarded it. But at the very least, of course, the MOU has to govern prospectively. But with respect, it should also apply to the currently existing records for a couple of reasons. Number one...
Yeah, I think you've gotten beyond the answer to the questions now, and unless my colleagues have further questions, we have once again exceeded the allotted time. And once again, it's our fault and not yours.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.